support for OPB comes from our members and from our sponsors, like Mike Rosenberg from Columbia Credit Union. Mike says they trust what they see and hear on OPB, and that aligns with Columbia Credit Union's brand.
It's OPB Politics Now for Friday, February 22nd. There is nothing quite like the threat of a ballot measure to spur state lawmakers into action. Take campaign finance limits. Lawmakers have promised for years to put a limit on how much an individual or an entity can contribute to a political race, but they kept failing. Then came the possibility of a ballot measure, and suddenly there is optimism that within the next 2 weeks or so, lawmakers could limit political contributions. We will break it down. I'm OPB Politics reporter Lauren Date.
And I'm OPB Politics reporter Dirk Vanderhart.
Dirk, Oregon is one of only five states with no limits on political donations. Lawmakers have spent months during long sessions trying to come up with a plan to prevent unions and people like Phil Knight from having an outsized influence on elections. But they always seem to run out of time. It never happens. And now suddenly they're saying they can get this done in the next 16 days.
Maybe. I mean, we don't know a ton about where lawmakers stand on this. What we do know is that they've got a proposal crafted by some of their most generous political donors that allegedly, according to them, creates a fair system of contribution limits both parties might find a reason to back. We're talking here about business groups that offer a lot of help to Republicans in elections and labor unions and advocacy groups that have been key to Democrats' success in Oregon. Those groups have been at work for weeks to craft a proposal that they could both get behind and have been shopping it to lawmakers who they're closely allied with. That creates the possibility, at least, that there could be bipartisan movement this year, though I think there are still a lot of questions.
So tell us what this latest proposal would do.
Okay, and I'm going to do that in some very broad strokes because this is a pretty complex system. But in general terms, the bill creates limits for how much a wide variety of entities can give to candidates, to political committees, to causes. That includes limits for businesses, for unions, interest groups, and just everyday Oregonians. At the most basic level, the bill sets a cap of $3,300 per election on donations to candidates from individuals. That's the same as current federal contribution limits, and it's obviously far less than the millions of dollars Phil Knight has sometimes poured into political races and also some other rich individuals that get really involved in politics. But the limits on individuals are just one piece of this, and certainly not all entities have such low limits. Small donor committees, these political groups that accept only relatively low donations from any one person, are often a point of contention in proposals like this. That's because they are pretty well in line with how unions raise money, and they're often given permission to spend a lot in these campaign finance proposals that we've seen. That's the case here. The bill would allow small donor committees to give hundreds of thousands of dollars potentially to candidates. So a big upper limit there. There are also some pretty generous limits for what are known as membership organizations, these nonprofit groups that can be set up by interest groups or business trade associations or really whoever. Under that bill, they have a high giving limit, including some provisions that let them supply campaign staffing. And I know I'm going on, but I want to mention one other thing that this bill tries to do, which is to create some requirements for disclosure. A big worry when campaign finance limits are enacted is that big money will move from going directly to candidates, as we have in Oregon, and that it will instead flow to what are called independent expenditures. These are essentially ads a group creates in support of a candidate without the knowledge or even input of the candidate. They are a huge feature of federal elections these days because the Supreme Court has ruled they can't be limited. And so this bill would attempt to force entities that spend a lot on independent expenditures to disclose those big donors. I think you get the picture at this point, Lauren. This is very, very complex.
One reason why it's historically been so hard to get campaign limits passed is because the unions, who are big Democratic supporters usually, and the business groups, who often support Republicans, cannot ever find common ground. How did they get around that this time?
Yeah, you know, both groups have been pretty frank. When I spoke to them earlier this week, they said they'd essentially been backed into a corner. These are people, you know, who have really used the state's relatively permissive laws over the years to their benefit. They like the system as it is. They argue that it's actually got an element of admirable transparency that could get lost with campaign limits. Here's Preston Mann. He's a lobbyist with Oregon Business and Industry, the state's largest business coalition, and he's one of the people who helped hammer out this proposal.
We think the current system, frankly, works just fine. It's easy to understand. It's transparent. Everybody's on the same playing field. But we're responding to a reality where campaign finance reform is coming. The days of the current system are over.
Here's what he means by that. A coalition of good government groups is currently pushing what is known as IP9. This is a campaign finance proposal that creates far stricter limits than labor or business wants. And it's got some other provisions that both groups and also lawmakers strenuously object to. But it also seems to stand a really good chance of making the ballot this year. And if it does that, voters have indicated in the past that they are eager to try to curb political money in the state. So unions and business groups and lawmakers, after all these years of delay that you've talked about, Lauren, see the writing on the wall, and they are essentially in hurry-up mode to see if they can pass a bill that might scuttle the ballot measure or at least get ahead of it.
And what have you been hearing from lawmakers about the proposal so far?
We haven't heard a ton. I mean, we know House Majority Leader Julie Fahey, who's going to be the next House Speaker, has been engaged and has been talking with business and labor as they negotiate. House Minority Leader Jeff Helfrich has also made clear he is interested. He's engaged. As we record this, actually, Lauren, the bill is getting its first hearing in the House Rules Committee that both Helfrich and Fahey serve on. And I thought Fahey had an interesting bit of testimony when she explained the history of campaign finance regulations and why they've been so difficult to pass. Here's what she said.
Finding agreement or compromise on an issue that people inside this building have such strong opinions on has proved to be very difficult over the years. And on top of that, the people outside of this building also have very strong opinions and have been unwilling to compromise. The labor unions have been too inflexible. Business leaders have not been willing to come to the table. And good government groups have not been willing to consider the practical implications of some of their positions.
And Fahey suggested that there has now been kind of a watershed moment where at least some of those groups have given up ground, and that that might be key toward passing some form of campaign finance regulation. She was pretty frank that she doesn't believe this proposal is perfect. She actually said she doesn't think there's any such thing as a perfect campaign finance system, given the opinions and strictures imposed by the U.S. Supreme Court. But lawmakers do, I have to say, at least some of them seem to agree they need to do something this year to get ahead of this ballot measure. That at least was the take that we heard at the hearing from Representative Rob Nose. He's a Portland Democrat. He didn't seem happy about it, but he seemed to say, we got to do something.
It seems like even under the current proposal, we might still be covering some pretty expensive races.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, one thing that came up at today's hearing is that even people backing this proposal don't actually think it's going to remove money from politics. So one thing you hear constantly when you start talking to people about campaign finance limits is that the actual money being spent is not likely to change all that much. In fact, more money might enter the system. It'll just get rerouted. That's because of those independent expenditures I mentioned. People with lots of money can still pay for their own ads supporting candidates they like. They just can't legally coordinate that spending with the candidate. And, you know, a lot of people in politics argue that's not ideal since candidates wouldn't be the people pushing their own messages in those cases. What the business and labor groups are arguing here is that their proposal contains high enough limits that candidates would still be able to generate enough money to run viable campaigns, but that they wouldn't be receiving some of the big checks anymore that tend to turn heads, get a lot of attention, maybe make people suspicious that politicians are being bought and paid for.
You reported that even if lawmakers do pass limits, voters could still see something on the ballot in November because the groups backing the initiative do not seem like they want to abandon that effort. So what happens if lawmakers and voters approve limits, but they're two different systems?
That is a very good question and something I'm not completely clear on right now. You know, there would have to be some sort of way that you could reconcile the two systems or figure something out. But you are right that the folks who are pushing IP9, the ballot measure that has helped ignite this debate, are pretty critical right now about this proposal. They have circulated a lengthy document sort of picking apart various elements of it. They think, you know, for instance, that the limits it contains are too high and could be easily exploited by rich donors that have some sophistication. They say this piece about disclosing donors for independent expenditure campaigns is ineffectual. They say enforcement of the laws could be lax and subject to politics. The group Honest Elections Oregon, which has been a major booster of campaign finance limits and actually wrote this proposal, IP9, has said it's open to trying to make the bill better, but is not clear that the changes it will want are palatable in the Capitol. And that could mean that IP9 moves forward, creating a fairly confusing situation if lawmakers do pass this bill.
Let's pivot to another area where lawmakers were arguably prompted to action by the threat of a ballot measure. We have talked a lot about Measure 110 on this podcast and the effort to make small amounts of illicit drugs illegal again. But now we have a lot more clarity on what that's going to look like. Jerk, tell us what you learned this week.
Yeah, so I think as we talked about, you know, the big debate this year has not been over whether Oregon should end drug decriminalization. Both parties seem to agree it should. The question was how that looked. Democrats proposed making possession of small amounts of illicit drugs a Class C misdemeanor, punishable by up to 30 days in jail. Republicans and their allies pressed for a Class A misdemeanor, which is punishable by up to a year. So there have been these sort of frenzied negotiations going on behind closed doors about this. And this week, we finally learned the outcome, which to me, I have to say, looks like Democrats meeting Republicans about halfway. I'll acknowledge that some Democrats don't exactly love that characterization. But what we learned on Wednesday was that a negotiated amendment would create an entirely new type of misdemeanor for drug possession. It would be punishable by up to 6 months in jail. But Democrats stressed that would only be in the most severe instances when someone failed their probation. Otherwise, they argue, you know, the new crime is unlikely to result in any jail time. And as they have all along, both sides say the goal is to convince drug users to seek treatment rather than get a criminal conviction. They have just been really arguing over what a criminal conviction could pose in terms of consequences.
Democrats also walked back a key piece of their initial proposal in an effort to win over some critics. Initially, they were going to require law enforcement to give drug users a choice to avoid criminal charges. But now, under the latest version, the so-called mandatory deflection is no longer mandatory.
Yeah, that's right. The first draft of the Democrats' bill had this requirement that police must offer a person caught with drugs the chance to connect with treatment rather than being brought to jail. And if the police officer didn't do that, the person could get the case tossed. But that turned out to be an unpopular idea with law enforcement groups and actually with public officials in some corners of the state who said they don't have the wherewithal to stand up a system like that. So in order to win broader buy-in, Democrats wound up scrapping the mandatory piece. Now they are making the system voluntary and asking district attorneys and county officials to come on board. We heard this week that something like 14 DAs have agreed, but I think there has been a lot of debate behind the scenes from counties who want to make sure that there's going to be enough state funding offered up to create these sorts of deflection systems before they commit to this.
Like you mentioned, there's still a lot of debate. They've appeased some groups, but there's still a lot of people who are pretty upset at this latest proposal.
Right. Yeah, very much so. I mean, advocacy groups who support drug decriminalization have pressed hard this year to convince lawmakers to back down. They have, you know, I think a lot of arguments to that. But a central theme is that the drug war has been a failure that has disproportionately impacted people of color. You know, they have said that lawmakers that might reinstitute criminal penalties for possession in an election year are doing that sort of as political theater, and that the move will have some dire outcomes. This week, they also essentially accused the lawmakers at the heart of these negotiations of ignoring the perspective of people of color and even freezing them out as they moved forward to negotiate this bill. These groups are now working to point out the major flaws they see in the system that's being proposed. But I have to say, it does seem that with these changes, Democrats are likely to bring Republican support and could get this passed. That's certainly what Senator Kate Lieber and Representative Jason Krupp, the two lawmakers sort of at the heart of this, seem to think.
There is something else worth pointing out here, too. With more people going to jail, there's going to be more people who need public defenders. And there is already a very severe and very problematic shortage of public defenders in this state. So will there now be even more people languishing in jail without any representation?
You know, I mean, that is a possibility or an argument some opponents have raised. Actually, public defenders have raised as well to some extent. I mean, not necessarily languishing in jail, but just being charged with a crime without having a public defender. As you point out, we do not have enough of these people right now to represent people with criminal charges under the existing system. You know, there is virtually no chance, obviously, that reintroducing a new crime for drug possession won't cause further strain on that system. And it likely just make it so more people are having their charges dropped because there's just not a lawyer to represent them. That's something I have to say that pretty much no one that is pressing for recriminalization has really addressed head on. But I did ask Senator Kate Lieber, a major architect of this bill, how she's thinking about it this week. Here's what she said.
That it's something that we are going to have to work through, but I'm not going to legislate for the moment that we're in. We need to legislate for beyond that moment. And we're going to continue to work with the court system and the public defenders and quite frankly, the rest of the system to make sure that they've got the investments that they need. And we've continued to do that.
And I think that's pretty similar to what you hear from other folks who are pressing for recriminalization. They think that the crisis that's been brought on by fentanyl addiction requires more muscular action, even though there are certain to be difficulties in the court system as a result. They really feel like something needs to be done.
Okay, Dirk, last question, and it's a bit of a philosophical one. Voters approved Measure 110, and some of the lawmakers who are now working to repeal the measure were ardent supporters for a very long time. And the core idea behind it, that throwing people in jail because of arguably a mental health issue, is something people really still believe is not the right thing to do. It's not worked in the past. So did Oregon just fail at this grand experiment so hard that now for the foreseeable future, Oregon and maybe other states will continue the practice of locking people up who have substance abuse struggles?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is obviously a matter of perspective, right? Folks who back Measure 110 argue that it's beginning to do good work, that it has been doing good work, that it needs more time to realize its potential before we pull the rug out. Folks who have always disliked the measure have been able to seize on some very worrying trends that have emerged in Oregon with fentanyl in the state to make the case to the public that it's been an utter failure. And we should be clear here that there is research that suggests that at least some of those difficulties were going to hit Oregon anyway, regardless of Measure 110, with the advent of fentanyl in the state. What I think does seem clear are a couple of things. The first is that Measure 110's rollout by pretty much any measure was very poorly executed. I mean, we are a state that had some of the lowest access to treatment services before the measure, and we decriminalized drugs without first making sure we would have enough. It was bad, and there is a lot of blame to go around for that, including to the people who actually pushed the measure. The second thing I'd say is that this looks to be a major blow nationally to advocates of decriminalization. I mean, assuming this bill or something like it gets passed, they will now have to contend with this case study of Oregon as they try to push something like it in other states. This, you know, we will be the state that tried decriminalization only to abandon it a few years later.
Dirk, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining me.
It's always a pleasure, Lauren.
This week's episode of OPB Politics Now was produced by Andrew Thien. Our audio engineer is Stephen Cray, and our music comes from Audio Network. We'll be back next week with more political news from across the Pacific Northwest. Until then, thank you for your support and thank you for listening.
I'm OPB Politics reporter Lauren Dake. OPB Politics Now helps you stay on top of important political news. But we know sometimes you just want to hear a good story. OPB's Relative Fiction podcast is a 6-episode series following author and illustrator Nicole Georges as she uncovers family secrets in an attempt to reconnect with her dad. It's a roller coaster of secrets, lies, and uncomfortable truths. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.